Welcome to Climate Seasons. I'm your host, Julie Hantman, and every 3 months I bring on a special guest to speak with me about climate change, sometimes the harms of climate change, more often the different positive efforts underway, and art, psychology, and more. Check out my past episodes at climateseasons.org. That's all one word, climateseasons.org. All right, a quick intro to today. The extreme heat out west has made me think, okay, climate and the climate crisis is way bigger than we even imagined. So we need more solutions that are up to the challenge, that are as big as the problems or bigger, and that can turbocharge progress. So rooting around a few weeks ago, I tripped across an organization I never heard of called Stop Ecocide, and it has some real cojones. So I am privileged today to welcome my guest, Jojo Mehta. She's the executive director of Stop Ecocide, and she's joining me today via a transatlantic Zoom call. Hello, Jojo. Welcome to Climate Seasons.
Hi, it's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, wonderful. And I'll give my very short understanding of what this is, just to get it out there, and then turn right back to you. Committing environmental and climate destruction is a crime. We're going to call it ecocide. And not only that, it's an international crime. Then we can prosecute certain corporations, nations at the International Criminal Court alongside genocide and crimes against humanity. This is big. This is huge. Tell us a little bit about your organization and the vision here.
Thank you, Julie. It's fantastic to be here. So our organization and our campaign was co-founded by myself and a UK lawyer called Polly Higgins, who is perhaps most strongly associated with the word ecocide. She spent the last 10 years of her life, she's no longer with us, working on promoting this concept and moving forward a possible crime of ecocide at the International Criminal Court. So although there are environmental laws around the world, there are thousands of them, we clearly are not seeing the end of destruction to nature. This is seems to be continuing unchecked and unpunished. And often laws that exist are not enforced well, or they're in the kind of regulatory sphere, and you know, companies, big corporations, often transnational corporations, simply employ expensive lawyers to work around those regulations, or perhaps they budget for the occasional court case. But if you criminalize destruction of ecosystems and you do it at the top level, what you're sending is a very, very strong message. You're saying not only, you know, are you going to fall foul of some regulations, but effectively your personal freedom as a decision maker could be on the line for making decisions which can potentially destroy the earth.
How much do you expect to get in terms of the actual criminal prosecutions out of the folks that you bring to criminal court?
That's a really interesting question, because actually the key aim of creating a crime of ecocide is actually to act as an enforceable deterrent. Of course, we realize once this crime comes into place, there will be cases taken. But really what we're aiming at, and this is the difference between the civil litigations that we see now in the environmental arena and doing what we're doing, is that what we want to see is a change in practice. We want to see those insurers, those investors, those corporate heads, government ministers even, looking at the infrastructure projects and the extractive projects that they're planning and thinking, am I going to fall foul of this law? You know, is this going to be criminal what I'm doing? In which case we need to move in a different direction. So what we're trying to create is less a kind of, you know, hammer to bash the bad guys with, much as that almost certainly will happen at some point, but more a kind of an incentive, a safety rail, a kind of parameter, a hard stop that allows those decision makers to start shifting their practices and their policies towards new ways of doing things. We all know that that's got to happen. You know, insurers know it, investors know it, policymakers know it. And yet we're doing it incredibly slowly. So when you look at the latest reports from the UN, you know, they're saying that, you know, the commitments to the Paris goals that countries are making at the moment to reducing their emissions is going to get us to 1% of, you know, where the emissions reductions that we should be seeing 45% of by 2030. So, you know, clearly there's nothing enforceable that's really helping people to move in the right direction, move away from the destructive extractive practices and actually look at methods and look at the scale of doing things and treat it in a different way. So, and interestingly, the way that it's been defined is it's about the risk of it. So effectively, if you're making a decision that you know has the potential, that's seriously likely to cause severe and widespread or severe and long-term damage, then if you go ahead, you're triggering that crime. So, and because in a way, what we're trying to do is preempt, is actually prevent the harm. You know, you don't want to have to wait until everything is destroyed and then look back and say, well, that was really bad and that was a crime. What you want to do is you want people to be looking at their infrastructure projects, for example, doing their due diligence and going, well, actually, we can't go in that direction because it will trigger that crime.
Got it. Yes. Thank you. All right. Next up, after a musical break, more with Jojo Mehta of Stop Ecocide.
Now that I love you so bad, I let you treat me like that. I was your willing accomplice, honey. And I watched as you fled the scene, though it is you buried me, one heart broke. For our hands bloody, the things I did just so I could call you mine. The things you did, well, I hope I was your favorite crime. Use me as an alibi.
I'm Julie Hantman with Climate Seasons on Tacoma Radio, WOWDLP 94.3 FM, with my guest Jojo Mehta, Executive Director of Stop Ecocide. Stop Ecocide asserts, hey, companies, countries, others who wantonly destroy the environment and the climate, they're committing a crime and they should be prosecuted by the International Criminal Court. Jojo, let's pick up right there. Why international? Why is this an international crime?
This is a really good question, and it really goes to the heart of the particular route that we pursue. So we aim to criminalize ecocide or mass damage and destruction of ecosystems at the International Criminal Court, and there are three key reasons for that. The first one is a kind of a practical legal reason, because the International Criminal Court, or ICC for short, is the only global mechanism which directly accesses the criminal justice systems of all its member states. It's a complementary court. Effectively, if you make something a crime there, any member state which ratifies that crime has to include it in their own domestic legislation in the same form. So effectively, it's a really practical way to get a key kind of ground rule adopted in the same form in lots of different jurisdictions. And that's really important with environmental crimes, because the worst offenders are transnational corporations, which have the capability of hopping from one jurisdiction to another, depending on where they think the rules are going to be most favorable. So that's very important. I mean, the second reason is more of a political one, in the sense that what we're finding is that individual governments are a little bit wary of jumping in with legislating for this by themselves. You know, they feel like they're putting themselves out on a limb. They might be jeopardizing existing economic relationships and so on. But supporting it at the international level is easier and safer politically, because you can be seen to be a leader in the space. And at the same time, you don't have to do anything immediately, but you know that when this does happen and it moves forward, there will be many countries doing it together, which obviously creates kind of safety in numbers and, you know, reduces that risk of kind of losing your competitive edge and all of those things. And of course, from our perspective, it also works better, because we do ultimately want a coherent rule that goes across many jurisdictions. And then the final reason, which ultimately may turn out to be the most important one of all, is actually more of a cultural and moral reason. Because if you put ecocide alongside genocide, alongside war crimes, so these really serious crimes, and the way that the ICC describes them is, you know, crimes of most serious concern to the international community as a whole. When you put ecocide up there, what you're saying is that damaging nature is as bad as damaging people, damaging property, you know, and that kind of has, you know, it can have quite a profound effect on the cultural consciousness, because what it's saying is saying at the highest level, it's a very, very strong message. And it addresses something that perhaps is not so conscious for most people, but is very strongly present in our culture. And that is that we have a very sort of separate mindset. We tend to think of ourselves, particularly in the sort of in the Western world, in the global north, you know, we tend to think of ourselves as separate from nature and sort of dominating nature. We treat nature as a bank of resources. We treat nature as something other that we are to, you know, to somehow master and use as a resource. In fact, even the Oxford English Dictionary defines nature as things that are other than human, which is kind of crazy if you think about it. I mean, when you actually delve into it, of course, we're a part of nature, and we deeply and completely depend on healthy ecosystems for our existence. So, you know, this very long-term, centuries-old approach of kind of, you know, dividing the mind from the body, dividing the, you know, man from nature, and it often is man as well rather than woman, I hasten to add. You know, that kind of mindset is what has brought us to the economic system we have currently globally, which is essentially an extractivist system with a kind of model of perpetual growth, and these kinds of sort of mindsets. Whereas if you're saying that, you know, our law, for example, is very anthropocentric as well. You know, it focuses around damage to people and property. And if you then put damage to nature alongside that, you're starting to somehow redress that balance. You're starting to reassert the importance of nature, which is a fundamental fact. You know, this law, we like to see this law almost as a kind of reality check, you know, as well as a, perhaps you could call it even a health and safety regulation for the planet, you know, but in the criminal sphere.
Some people listening may not know about the International Criminal Court. Could you just give us a basic sort of lesson or reminder? And of course, that was the locus of tremendous moral force back in the 1940s.
Absolutely. So as you probably may know, I mean, the terms genocide and crimes against humanity were coined in the 1940s at the Nuremberg trials after the Second World War. And really since then, there's not been, you know, conceptually speaking, there's not been a new international crime concept, if you like. So this concept of adding ecocide is a new one. Now, the ICC came into existence as a result of the Rome Statute Treaty being signed in 1998, and the court itself was established in 2002. And it governs these crimes that are considered, you know, atrocity crimes, the worst crimes against humanity as a whole, if you like, against the world community, and the well-being of the world, which is actually one of the phrases that they use. And it's based in The Hague, which is a UN agency. The court itself is independent, and it has currently 123 member states, and it acts as what, as I mentioned before, as a complementary court. So if one of these crimes is committed in a member state, and for some reason that state can't or won't prosecute, then the international court can step in as a kind of a backup, if you like. And it also means, what it also does for the first time, is it removes the impunity and I suppose the level of political immunity that is there for heads of state. So it usually in their own country, it's very difficult for a head of state to be prosecuted. But a head of state can be prosecuted at the International Criminal Court. So it goes a step above national law. It's complementary with, but it goes a step above. And that's very important because it, you know, it means that, you know, for victims of certain kinds of crimes, it's the only place that they can actually appeal. Because in something with something like genocide or war crimes, often the country itself won't prosecute the controlling minds of that crime. With ecocide, it's a little bit different in the sense that the breadth of potential prosecution is actually surprisingly wide. But because ecocide is more of a corporate crime, you know, potentially, you know, the head of a corporation could be tried in any ratifying country. So even though the US, for example, is not a member of the International Criminal Court, if a US company was committing ecocidal activity in a country that was a member, then they could be prosecuted there. So, you know, so there's actually more of an applicability in practice for prosecutions than might initially seem to be the case.
Wow. At several levels, this is really potentially very, very effective law. What's the status? You've got this draft definition. What happens next?
Well, this is really exciting because, I mean, in fact, it's been wonderful to see the response to the emergence of this legal definition because, you know, we've been working on this for many years. Over the last couple of years, there's been a huge growth in momentum. And we would attribute that in part to sort of certain international reports coming out that have made it clear, you know, the sort of dire straits that we're in environmentally, but also the kind of on the ground climate mobilizations, such as the school strikes or Extinction Rebellion or the Sunrise Movement, you know, these kind of on the ground activist movements, which have really opened up the discussion in the media. And that in turn has opened it up at the political level. So that now what we're saying, which perhaps a few years ago might have been considered a bit extreme, is now starting to look very much more like common sense, which of course we've always maintained it was. But it certainly seems like the time is right for taking something a bit more muscular, shall we say, in the legal arena into this mix of potential solutions to the climate crisis and ecological crisis. And this definition coming out has really ignited a lot of interest worldwide. And our job now is to really expand the conversation, to do so on different levels. So firstly, obviously, within civil society and the public narrative, because that's what creates the pressure on governments. And that is really picking up now. And secondly, of course, and this is more behind closed doors, is at the diplomatic level. So we're already in discussion with a large number of states, actually. There's a lot of curiosity. There's quite, you know, there are even countries that are starting to move quite quickly since the definitions emerged. I mean, just in the last couple of weeks, you know, there's a parliamentary committee in Belgium that's been submitted a resolution using this definition. There's a parliamentary committee in Bangladesh, even in the UK, which is not best known for its sort of radical environmentalism. There is now an amendment in a government bill that's going through, you know, to include ecocide crime. So we're looking at encouraging all of that, of course. And I think one of the things that's proving really inspiring is that there's something in the word itself, ecocide, which has its own internal momentum, because I think many of us can see that serious damage is happening to nature in many, many different areas. And so to have a word that brings that all together, which ecocide does, is really helpful. And also, as soon as one understands that word, there's almost this kind of automatic response, like a moral response. Well, that's bad and that should stop. And there's something about that which really helps us to kind of spread the word, you know, literally spread the concept. So that's being very helpful. And what we would aim for is potentially by next year, ideally, to have a group of interested states willing to propose this amendment to international law. So that's kind of what we're aiming at. And really, the next sort of year or so is going to all be about amplifying the conversation, having as many people understand what we're talking about as possible. Because to be honest, I've yet to meet someone one-on-one that thinks this is a bad idea. It's one of those things that, the political space is now starting to move towards, a place where governments, we genuinely hope and believe, will actually be embarrassed to say they don't want to look at this.
Wow. I'm thinking of ecocide, like you said, it kicks you in the gut and takes your attention. And it means, apparently, killing one's home in Greek. And it reminds me of what the Pope entitled his encyclical, right? Laudato si, is that Latin for something similar, our common home, no?
Well, Laudato si, strictly speaking, is talking about praising the creator, but the content of that encyclical was very much focusing on care for our common home. And our common home is, of course, the planet. And you're quite right. I mean, ecocide is actually a mixture of Greek and Latin. So eco is home in oikos, comes from home in Greek, and side comes from cedere, to kill in Latin. So it's to kill one's home. And of course, our planetary home is, certainly right now it is our only home, and we would do well to be looking after it. And what's interesting, actually, is that the Pope was the first head of state, in fact, obviously of the Vatican State, to endorse this idea of ecocide as an international crime in 2019, shortly before the small island nations, Vanuatu and the Maldives, actually called for it at the International Criminal Court. They were the first to do that, and they brought that conversation back onto the kind of international governmental level where it hadn't been for nearly 50 years. So it's really interesting. And I think it's almost ironic that, it's the spiritual leader like the Pope, and also spiritual leaders such as indigenous leaders, of whom there are many who are behind this movement. It takes the spiritual leaders to point out what is really a factual reality, which is that we are deeply dependent on the ecosystems around us and on the health of Mother Earth, if you like, for our well-being and for the future of human civilization. And by contrast, you have the sort of, secular economists and politicians who like to think of themselves as being very fact-based, ultimately operating on some crazy kind of faith that the system that we've got is that we can carry on with impunity, when it quite clearly isn't the case.
Let's take another musical break. More with Jojo Mehta of Stop Ecocide after the break, and we'll be looking a little more at next steps and where's the U.S. in all of this. Stay tuned. I'm Julie Hantman with Climate Seasons on Tacoma Radio, WOWDLP 94.3 FM in Tacoma Park, Maryland. And today I'm with my guest, Jojo Mehta from Stop Ecocide. And we are back talking about how to make environmental climate destruction an international crime and what everyone here listening can even do about it. Let's say more about where the status is right now of the effort.
Absolutely. So we're already in a position where we have around 10, I believe now. I mean, it's literally going up week by week. Member states of the ICC, of the International Criminal Court, who are recording an interest at government level in various ways. So Vanuatu and the Maldives are the two island nations that first brought it up, but France has been discussing it, Belgium's been discussing it. In fact, Belgium was the first European country to bring it up in their official statement at the International Criminal Court. We have the foreign affairs committees in Spain and Belgium have been discussing it, the Finnish foreign ministry as well. Canada and Luxembourg have both said that they're kind of watching with great interest. And as I said, the UK has is looking at a government bill at the moment that has an ecocide amendment in it. So there are, you know, there are quite a large number of countries now that have got this discussion sort of becoming live. And at the parliamentary level, generally, there is a kind of global support, at least in principle. There's an organization called the Interparliamentary Union, which has delegations from 179 parliaments around the world. And they recently had a vote, it was just in May of this year, which included a resolution on supporting ecocide crime in principle. And I think only three countries did not agree with that. So it was virtually unanimous. So there's, you know, there is definitely a sort of strong global momentum around this. We do have to say that there is, you know, there are some countries that are not members of the ICC, and the US is one of those. So it might be interesting to perhaps address a little bit what is happening in the US with this.
Please, yeah.
So at the moment, there's not, to our awareness, there's not a discussion in the political sphere yet in the US. But what we are starting to have is quite a strong kind of advocacy group growing up in the US. And so the conversation is starting to grow there, sort of in the public sphere, at least it's beginning to. And this is important because, you know, the US may not be yet a member of the ICC. I mean, maybe one day it will be, we hope so. But also, but what the US does have is very loud voices that the whole world can hear. You know, a lot of, you know, key public figures in the US have the potential to really amplify this conversation. So that's one aspect that we're looking at. But another thing that I think it's really worth considering is something we didn't expect when we first launched this campaign. When we launched the campaign in 2017, what we thought we were doing was crowdfunding for diplomatic work. In other words, we had a grassroots following that were interested and potentially would put some funds behind this, whereas more established, you know, funding foundations thought it was still a bit extreme. However, what we found over time is that it's actually much more than that, because where we have campaigns on the ground, where people are having conversations about ecocide in their own language, in their own culture, in their own walks of life, we're seeing that those are also the places where the political conversation changes and it starts to become a subject of discussion. And that's hugely encouraging and empowering, because, you know, to your average person on the street, international criminal law can feel a little bit remote. You know, it can feel like it's kind of over there on the moon. You know, I mean, most people, you know, if you're not a lawyer, you tend to think of law as something that's being done by lawyers and that you know, you don't have anything much to do with it. But what we're seeing in practice is that where those conversations are happening, the political dial is also getting pushed. So that means that actually everybody listening to this program has the potential to actually affect this conversation, because you are all, you know, in different walks of life doing different things and have different networks, and we all have networks. And as I was saying before the break, you know, this word itself, ecocide, has its own internal momentum. So when you talk about it and that word spreads, that is coming, that is trickling up. And we know it is, because then we're having politicians contacting us saying, tell us, what is this ecocide thing I'm hearing about?
I can't wait to hear that someone who listened to Tacoma Radio got in touch with one of their elected officials and they were the first one to bring it up on the floor of the House.
That would be fabulous.
Yes. There are so many advocacy groups on the ground and doing so many important things. How do you layer this project on top of that, or with integrate it with that? How can people support this idea and perhaps other layers as well of the response to climate change?
I think this is a fantastic question, because what we've realized is that this is a huge collaborative exercise. It's a big dot joining exercise. I mean, criminalizing ecocide, you know, it's not going to fix everything, but it's a kind of, it's almost like an acupuncture needle. You know, it's a strategic intervention at a very key pressure point, which potentially can support every environmental campaign that's out there. You know, whether you're trying to save the bumblebees or the whales or, you know, ancient woodlands, or you're trying to, you know, campaign against fossil fuels, you know, it's relevant to all of those things. So we are not in competition with any other environmental campaign. We absolutely support all of them. And an easy way to think of this, I mean, you know, if you campaign for human rights, at least you know that mass murder and torture are crimes, right? But if you're campaigning for, you know, the preservation and protection of the environment, you're operating on a void because there is no ground rule that says this much damage is simply not permitted. And that is what this can provide. And so bringing all of those voices together, you know, is really important. And one of the things we've just launched, and it's been very successful in the first country that's done it, which is Spain. And that is a manifesto for organizations, NGOs, and campaign groups to get behind to say, you know, we all support in all of our areas and looking at the environment, we all support this idea of ecocide as a crime. And we've now translated that. We have it in English. We have it on our website on stopecocide.earth, along with many other actions that you can take, you know, where you can get your particular network or your favorite charity or whatever it is that you support to potentially endorse this crime, because it will support what you're doing.
That's extremely effective. And by the way, listening to you just now, I finally got it through my noggin that, of course, fossil fuels and the sale of fossil fuels is embedded, well, it's legal, and it's also embedded in our economy, and the profound change that it is to say, wait, there's this underlying law where what you're doing, you don't say it's what you're doing, because what you're doing is digging up fossil fuel and selling it at the pump or whatever. But what you're also doing is destroying the climate and environment. And that, my dear, is a crime. You cannot do that. So they have to change how they're doing. So thank you. I actually sort of got it at a very visceral level. Yeah. Well, we only have a few more minutes. Do you want to say more about, I don't know what this journey is like for you to be at the helm of a very unique effort, it seems to me.
It's hugely exciting, I have to say. I mean, it's really inspiring because, and I remember when I very first read about this, before I even met Polly Higgins, who was the figurehead for the movement while she was still alive, I remember reading about it and thinking, wow, that sounds like the biggest game in town. You know, it's like, you know, if you could just go to these guys and say, well, do you know what? All this terrible damage you're doing, you're just not allowed to do it anymore. You know, it just seems like such a simple, obvious thing, you know, a kind of no-brainer, I suppose. And so, it feels, you know, very kind of, what's the word? I mean, it kind of feels obvious in a way. And so it's very inspiring movement to be working in. It's very collaborative. We've got campaign teams now in, you know, I think 18 countries, or associate groups. You know, it's a really growing movement. And on one level as well, it's almost the easiest campaign in the world to be talking about, because who's going to argue with you? I mean, you know, I'm not saying that there aren't people that would want to object. I mean, I'm sure that the big oil and gas companies would prefer this not to come into force. But at the same time, you know, they're spending all of their money, all of their publicity money greenwashing. They're not going to come out publicly and say this is a bad idea. That would undo all the work that they've been doing in the last 20 years to try and give us the impression that they're ecologically sound. You know, so if there is opposition, doesn't tend to be in the public sphere, because, you know, there's already such a strong zeitgeist that something really important needs to be done, really serious needs to be done, that, you know, that kind of resistance is not happening in the public arena so much. So it's very exciting. And I think the other sort of empowering side of working with this, you know, is kind of knowing that, you know, this is not just the stick, you know, it's also a carrot, because, you know, the stick side is the, you know, the enforceable deterrent, you know, the line of the law and all of that. But there's also a way in which it actually draws us forward. It encourages us. So all the activists, all the experts, all the academics, you know, all the NGOs, everyone who is working to improve environmental law will be supported by this. You know, it will really help to sort of pull everything forward, and it will still remain as a kind of an umbrella crime, if you like, kind of over the top of that, because the way that it's been drafted is kind of future proof. You know, it avoids specific numbers and it avoids specific actions. But what it says is,
the severe damage is what's not allowed. And so no matter what ecocidal nonsense somebody's going to dream up next year, you know, if it's going to create this amount of damage, it won't be allowed. And that just, it just feels like it's that, that idea again of the safety rail. You know, it's like, we need that sense of where is the parameter to keep us on the right track. And it just feels like an enormous privilege, actually, an enormous privilege and hugely exciting to be working on this.
Thank you so much. Is there any resource that you would like to point listeners to other than your website, which I've mentioned, stopecocide.earth? I also actually will mention on my website, where this will be archived later, climateseasons.org, that there's an ongoing excellent series of articles by insideclimatenews.org combined with NBC, and they're doing a terrific articles this year, really building on the progress about the new definition of ecocide and in general. But anyway, is there any other resources you would commend to people to learn more about ecocide or take action?
Absolutely. So the take action menu, if you like, you'll definitely find on our website that you just listed, stopecocide.earth. But there is also, for those more, you know, interested in the history of it, the legal side, you know, the kind of nitty gritty of that side of things, there, we also have a website called ecocidelaw.com. So ecocidelaw.com is co-managed by ourselves, by our foundation, and also the Promise Institute for Human Rights at the University of California, Los Angeles, their School of Law. So that's managed by the two organizations. And that's also where you'll find the official, you know, version of the definition and, you know, any translations as they arise and so on. So that's a good resource. Also, if you go to our main site, stopecocide.earth, and you look under, I think it's, there's a page called Our Network. And what that has is a whole, it shows you all the sites for all the people who are, you know, the different organizations that are really coming together around this. So there's an organization of parliamentarians worldwide. There's an organization that's dealing with business leaders on this subject. There's another website that's dealing with the faith groups on this subject. So, you know, this is really kind of a collaborative effort of you know, everybody kind of moving together.
Well, thanks again so, so much for taking your time to speak with us, Jojo Mehta of Stop Ecocide, and have a wonderful day.
Thank you so much.
Yes. And this is Climate Seasons, Tacoma Radio, WOWDLP 94.3 FM. And we're going out. Thanks.
He did it. He did it. Estes, a friend of mine. We meet up every Tuesday night for dinner and a glass of wine. Estes, been losing sleep. Her husband's acting different and it smells like infidelity. She says, that ain't my Merlot on his mouth. That ain't my jewelry on our joint account. No, there ain't no doubt. I think I'm gonna call him out. She says, I think he did it, but I just can't prove it. I think he did it, but I just can't prove it. I think he did it, but I just can't prove it. No, nobody, no crime, but I ain't letting up until the day I